on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. You know, I haven't defended that idea, the thesis that the wonderful British person, actress, just told you in the introduction. Yeah, it's true. Let me go through it really fast for our new listeners. Creativity, risk, and passion are awesome for you, maybe, but not for me. Let me explain. 93% of businesses are startups that are copies of other businesses. The idea that I have to sit around and wait for a lightning bolt or have this brilliant new idea is crazy. All you need is find an idea and go copy it. We're not going to try to be unique. That's just too hard. So why not copy like 93% of the rest of the entrepreneurs do? Risk. I think you can prove your business model for $5,000, or probably you shouldn't do it. And that means hardcore bootstrapping. And we talk about that all the time on the show. We have entire episodes about it. Go to the index and find several of those. I don't think you need that much money to start. You shouldn't have an office space before you have income. You shouldn't have your logo on a t-shirt before you have income. All right. Hardcore bootstrap. And then passion. I reserved for the church, the synagogue, the mosque, and the family. You do not need to be passionate about your idea. You just need to like it more than working for the man. That's all that you need to do. It's a spectrum, right? And pure utopia is at one end and working for the man is on the other end, right? You only have to be past working for the man. If you love your business, that is icing on the cake. You're just double lucky. Great show today. First up, we have Fred Joyle with us. He is the superhero behind 1-800-DENTIST. And has a new book out called Super Bold. Fantastic conversation we have on introversion and risk. And he started out as a stand-up comedian. We will talk about the import of that. Just a great interview. And then Lavesha Davis is with us. She is very impressive, running a virtual family office consulting business, consulting on how to have your family office. So helping people have family offices. It's an amazing conversation. I was really impressed with her, and I'm excited for you to meet her as well. So that is a great show for you. We're going to get started in just a second.
On climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us today. Boy, am I excited to welcome back Fred Joyle to the show. He was with us before, and not only does he have just an amazing background and pedigree that we want to talk about, his book is very dear to my heart. His whole idea, and we'll talk about it in a second, is something I agree with so much. And I think it's so important that people hear this message. And so I'm really glad that Fred will be back with us. He is the founder of 1-800-DENTIST. You all know that. That's a company that sort of defines itself, and great URL and all of that. Hard to forget the name of that one. Had huge success there. We will talk about that. He has written several books, and most recently his book is entitled Super Bold, From Underconfident to Charismatic in 90 Days. It is 5-star rated with 100 5-star reviews, which is very impressive. Fred, welcome back to the show. How are you doing today?
Awesome, Jim. Really excited to talk to you again.
All right. So let's go right there super bold. Give us the thesis and your, just give us the whole rundown.
Yeah, so I've started out as a very introverted person in life, and it really wasn't working for me, but I thought it was, you know, something people were born with. And then I gradually figured out that it was learnable, because I would emulate bold people, even though it made me incredibly uncomfortable. And what happened is I got bolder and bolder, and I got rewarded for it. So I eventually realized many years later that I wanted to teach people this, that so that they could chase their dreams and pursue their careers more boldly and more successfully. And so that's what led to the book, and now me speaking on it. And the next step is I'm also going to be launching a video course next year, teaching this life skill.
Why was introversion not working for you? You said, what does that mean? How does that manifest?
You know, I would miss out on opportunities because I would.
Girls?
Oh, it definitely meant girls. It certainly meant dating. I think that was the biggest pain point, but there were others where I couldn't step up. The first opportunity I had to sell, I was brought into this company. I was working in this machine shop, and the owner said, "I think you could be one of our salespeople." I was just working on the shop floor as a shop hand. And he said, "You're a smart guy. I think you could sell." And he sat me down with a phone and a list of businesses in the state. And he said, "Here, start calling these people and see if they want to do business with us." I couldn't dial the phone. I couldn't make a single phone call.
Fingers, is that the problem?
Yeah. So it's like, well, it was a rotary phone, you know, and I just couldn't figure out how to make it work. You know, that hesitation and from underconfidence and, you know, and this fear of rejection, all this crazy stuff that we do that, you know, eventually if you're smart enough and bold enough, you figure out that that's a lot of nonsense we tell ourselves. And that's why some people succeed much more widely and vastly and satisfyingly, is because they step up, they speak up, they try stuff, they take risks. The very definition of risk is that you don't know how it's going to go. And so if you're trying to play it safe your whole life, it's going to be a pretty dull and unsatisfying life.
All right. Very interesting. And was this a process, Fred? Did you wake up and say, "I'm introverted and I'm going to try to change myself, and here's what I'm going to do"?
A lot of times it's a series of frustrations, and then one's big enough, you miss a big enough opportunity. And for me, it was a woman that I thought I could have had a great long relationship with, possibly as my wife, but I didn't speak up and she didn't speak up, and the opportunity disappeared. And I later found out that she was extremely interested in pursuing the relationship, was waiting for me to speak up. And that was kind of it. And I said, you know what, this has to stop. And so I just realized I just had to be uncomfortable until I wasn't. And so that I would do bold things, and I wouldn't do them well, and I would be uncomfortable doing them, but I just got better at them. And like all of a sudden,
what kind of bold things, Fred? Taking your trash out without your shoes on? What?
Yeah, no, in my underwear, you know, in the winter, you know, just for the fun of it. I mean, I started to do crazy things where it didn't really matter, that there were really no consequences except in my head. And that sort of reinforced the whole process of becoming bolder, because I would do silly things. I would do stuff. And eventually I tried improv comedy. And that was where I learned, because I learned, and that's what informed really the book, Super Bowl because it's a combination of neuroscience and improv comedy in terms of how we learn and can develop this. Improv comedy starts non-verbally. When you start to learn how to do it, you don't even use words right away. It builds very gradually, but you get to the point where you can walk on stage, take a suggestion from the audience, and with a partner, create a scene out of nothing. And once you do that, you say, oh, well, there's unlimited possibilities for discovery if I just don't stop myself. That's a big shift. And you, when you realize you're the one stopping you more than anybody else, and you decide to not be that person anymore, and then suddenly stuff just happens. The bold people realize that the unexpected happens when you step out of your comfort zone. So they start to expect the unexpected. It's kind of a contradiction, I guess you'd say there. But that's the way I am. Is I'll go into stuff not knowing how it's going to go. It could go really badly. And very often, it doesn't go the way I want it to, but something more interesting happens, something better, something unusual. And either way, if it goes completely badly, if it's a total failure, I just look at it as information now. I used to look at it as a reason to retreat and never try that sort of thing again. So I shifted that. I shifted my behavior because I shifted my mindset to not defining failure as anything other than a step towards what I was going for instead of a reason to hide, crawl back in my shell and retreat.
And then the tiger walked into the room.
Yes.
What's the phrase in improv? Yes, but, or something like that?
No, yes, and. Yes. That's the whole idea, is you always add something. You never contradict what was just said. You add to it. And it becomes a great way of thinking as you approach stuff. You say, this situation, they don't I don't have a badge to go into this meeting with a bunch of CEOs, but I'd really like to meet some of them. So I don't have a badge and I'm going to go in instead of, but I shouldn't because they might throw me out. I understand they might throw me out, but if I don't try, I've guaranteed that they don't even have to throw me out because I didn't even go in. And I've done that exact thing. I've walked into meetings I don't belong and end up having dinner with everybody. And I could have easily been asked to leave.
What's the trick to making that work, Fred? How do you, tell us the lesson there. How do you make that work?
It's a mindset shift. If you start to tell yourself, I belong everywhere, because we're all human beings. CEOs are just people, and very often little boys or little girls inside who just got somewhere, got lucky somehow, and and got better at stuff. Sometimes because they learned, but a lot of times because they failed upwards. They figured that out. So if you start to just say, wherever I am, I belong here. I want to be in that room. I belong there. If I see, the Prime Minister of England, and he's in a room talking to a bunch of people, I'm not going to tell myself I don't belong in there. I'm just going to walk in and chat him up. And I have met amazing people because of that. Because one, when you act like you belong everywhere, you behave like a normal person instead of somebody who's anxious or a drooling fan or tongue-tied or awkward. you just say, I belong everywhere. And that's really what happens, is you start to radiate this confidence that you're comfortable wherever you are in whatever situation. And it takes time to get there, but anybody can get there.
I think that this might be a good time to introduce the pride method.
Yes, yes. Very simply, it's a five-step process of doing boldness exercises to build your boldness like you would build a muscle by taking these five steps. Now, I break them down in my book in a lot more detail, but the PRIDE method is an acronym: preparation, relaxing, insights, dosage, and everyday action. So very simply, you would, if you wanted to meet somebody in line at Starbucks, you would prepare what you were going to say. You don't just hope you're going to come up with something. You say, I'm going to compliment them on their glasses. And then if you're feeling a little anxious, then you need to relax yourself by doing a simple breathing exercise and adjusting your physiology. Now, I'm compressing all of this. That's the P and that's the R. The I is insights. And then one of the key insights is 99% of the time, nothing bad happens unless you decide to label it that way. And then it might be bad to you. And also, the second insight that's critical is that people aren't thinking about you anywhere near as much as you think they are. They're thinking about themselves. If they have a judgment about you, how accurate could it possibly be? I have judgments about people all the time that I know are stupid. I'll see somebody and I'll go, that guy should never wear that color suit. He looks ridiculous. And of course, if I talk to them for 5 minutes, I realize the suit was deliberate and it's all part of his whole style. And I end up really liking the guy. But if I'm having judgments that are completely wrong about people, people are doing the same thing about me. So why worry about it? They couldn't possibly, they don't know me. The number of people who really know me is a handful. Those people's opinions matter to me. And everybody else, they can have their opinion, but that's their business. And their dosage, comes from improv. As you work your way up, you control the intensity of your venture into your discomfort zone, into your bold action. You don't try to do huge, crazy things. If you wanted to become a public speaker, you don't start by getting yourself in front of 1,000 people and hoping it goes well. You go to Toastmasters and you work with the most supportive people imaginable, or you get your family together and you do a 5-minute PowerPoint presentation. You control the dosage and then you increase it gradually. So you're always uncomfortable, because what happens is your comfort zone gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then everyday action. It's every day. Two words. Do something every day towards becoming bolder. Do a boldness exercise. Smile at a stranger. Talk to a stranger. Put on a wig and go walk around in a supermarket and say, wow, nobody really thought about this that much. It wasn't that big a deal. But when you work on something every day, it aggregates and you get closer and closer and closer to your dream. It's not how much you do so much as how consistently you do it. That's why if you decide, well, I'm always going to do a boldness exercise somewhere through the day before I go to bed. If I haven't done one, I'm going to go out to a 7-Eleven and introduce myself to a stranger. Just get to it every day. So that's the PRIDE method.
I love it. So many stories are jumping to mind, and I'll tell just this one. A woman and her roommate were sitting around in college saying, you know, no one asked me out tonight. And one of the women, I think, was engaged, and the other one was lamenting that they weren't asked out. And the one who was engaged said, go out for the next week and every boy that you like, that you wish had asked you out, just give them a good smile, smile at them, like, and look them at the eye and let them know that you are smiling because of them. She was engaged 6 months later. I mean, that small boldness of her smiling at the boys she thought were cute, eventually that gave the boy confidence enough to, you know, say, hi, you want to go out? And, you know, 8 children later, they own the largest Plymouth dealership in Detroit.
Yeah. And she was radiating, I'm unapproachable, without knowing it.
That's right.
She was just being shy. And as soon as she started smiling, she just said, I'm approachable. And then the right person approached her. It's a fascinating thing. But yeah, that's how it plays out. You don't realize that people go, well, I'm shy. Well, it's like you're radiating aloof without knowing it, which is not helpful.
Or arrogance or something else. Fred, let's switch topics. And I'm afraid we have to pay attention to the time. And we have a long way to go still. Go back to pre-800 dentists when we only had 799 dentists and the world hadn't yet, you know, discovered this. Get us ready in terms of what you were doing entrepreneurially, you know, your financial situation, you know, just what were you doing prior to that? And then how'd you get the idea? And then tell us about 800 dentists. Go. I'm going to put you on mute. I'm just going to let you go and tell me some history.
So I did all sorts of jobs over the years. I ran a little painting enterprise, house painting. I worked in a machine shop. I sold frozen meat door to door. I worked in the post office for a while. I could do 3 to 6 month jobs all over the place. And then I discovered advertising. And I realized I had found my tribe. I had found something that I could do happily for a long time because I loved writing, but I couldn't figure out how to survive. And then I became a copywriter in an agency and everything changed. And that was a trigger to becoming more bold because I had to pitch ideas and get a beating because the idea wasn't good enough and then come up with another one. And eventually what happened is somebody who owned the 800 dentist phone number saw me working in advertising. He said, I think you could turn this into a business. This was a friend of mine. And so another friend of mine wanted to quit his job. And so we were young and naive enough to go and try to do it. And we beat the streets. We talked to 250 dentists, I think, to find our first 18 doctors who wanted to go along with it in Los Angeles. Ran some radio ads, and we got 50 phone calls the first day in our little phone room at 200 square feet. And we realized, wow, this, what we've been telling people might actually be true. This will actually get them patients. And so we just kept adding cities and adding dentists every month. And I'd be driving all around LA picking up checks and with my little cassette radio, cassette player and playing the radio spots that we had recorded that we were running to get dentists to participate. And of course, the business evolved and evolved and evolved over the next 25 years. But we were doing close to $50 million a year by the end, you know, and, you know, Google eventually chewed us up and spit us out. But, you know, we had a heck of a run doing it and it still runs. It's a much smaller business. I sold it about 8 years ago now to a much smaller enterprise. It was in decline. And this person figured out how to make it work as a purely digital kind of business with almost no employees. I had 250 employees for several years, but that was the story. And it was, you know, all the twists and turns of any business, the ups and downs and the economic shifts, the recessions and everything along the way, we created a great business with a great culture. We were into culture long before people even used the term, because we wanted a great place where we wanted to go to work every day. And that made all the difference in the business. So that's the story of 800 Dentists.
Very cool. I would love to ask the lessons you learned from it. And we actually have a structured way to do that. It's called the Quick 10. I heard you want to play.
Yeah, I do. I do.
All right. Do you want to accept the standard wager?
Yes.
There you go. I love the attitude. Number one, your favorite creativity hack.
My creativity hack is, my favorite one is what I call an espresso nap. If I'm starting to hit a wall in terms of thinking and problem solving or creativity, I make myself a shot of espresso and I immediately lie down and I set my phone for 20 minutes. And the alarm goes off in 20 minutes. As I take this little nap and the caffeine is kicking in right about 20 minutes, and all of a sudden I'm energized, but I've also sort of cleared my brain out and let it just play. And almost invariably, I start to get on track again. I start to flow with new solutions.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
Is approach people and pre-sell whatever you're selling at half price. And the deal is they have to give you feedback on the product. So they have to use it. And so you get money and the user, you get some income, half what you normally would or hoping to get, instead of just an advisor. And it's a great way to pressure test the pricing and whether the marketplace cares about what you have.
Number three, name your top passions.
Speaking on stage about boldness, number one. I love writing, number two, both fiction and nonfiction. And I love reading, both reading and nonfiction. And I'm one of my passions is stand-up comedy. I love it. I love it whenever I can get out there and see it, not do it. I did it for a very brief period. It was a great experience. And the other, not last at all, I love coaching young entrepreneurs.
Number four, the
helping
first
them not make the same mistakes I made, you know? So
the first three steps in starting a business are?
You got to have an idea. And then you got to research if there are competitors to this idea. I've had people pitch me ideas, and I would say to them, they have that. That exists already. And then the third step, so important, plan on living on nothing, on surviving on as little as possible for the next year or two as you start this business.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Ask 20, 30, 40 people for advice on your business, but they have to be your ideal customer. And one of them is going to say, well, can I get this? And there he is. There she is. Your
number
first
six,
customer.
Your dreamiest technology is?
is the Jetson 3. The Jetson one is out, but I want to wait till there's a three. I want to wait till maybe it's got a windshield, and they've solved a few of the challenges of very new technology since I will be in the air. But I would love to get places faster. I'm an impatient man. I want to get from A to B as fast as possible.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice.
As soon as possible in the business, lock yourself in so there's no way out. There's only forward. There's only through. And a lot of times it happens easily with an entrepreneur because you sign personally on everything. Sign personally on the lease. You sign, you put everything on your own credit cards. And eventually you have to figure it out. You have to make money because otherwise you're doomed.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake.
Raising too much money. it's interesting because people go, I would want a lot of money for a buffer. But the problem is if you get too much cash, you use it to solve your problems instead of using creativity, instead of pushing for insights, and instead of working late. You just throw money at the problems and you don't learn anything.
Number 9, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Richard Branson. Because he knows he got lucky and then he leveraged that luck and he feels the responsibility to give back and does it constantly and brilliantly.
Number 10, favorite superhero?
It's got to be Iron Man. You know, because he's so brainy and he's got that great gear and I enjoy his sarcasm.
Brad, thanks for playing. We will get our score here in just a second. How do we find out more about you, follow you online, hire you to coach us, get the Super Bold book, all that, please?
So the book Super Bold is on Amazon. It's in hardcover and Audible, and it's me reading it and on Kindle. And I have an app, Fred Joyle, and I have a website, fredjoyle.com. That's how you can book me to speak. I'd love the opportunity to speak to your team and get them fired up to have a bold 2026. That's how to find me.
Fantastic. Brad, I'm just kind of pausing. Oh, I'm so sorry for you. I'm so sorry. You got a 94. Maybe one of our judges. One of our judges was the president of the Introverted Society, and he didn't like your message, and so he dinged you some points. I'm really sorry about that. So, unfortunately, you have to have a 95 to win. You got a 94. So, you lost the wager, and you owe us a Tesla. You owe us a Tesla.
I hate that when I have to give people Teslas.
Yeah, so I will look forward to that soon, and I appreciate being on the show today. You were great. Thank you so much. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you, Jim. I'll be back.
And we will be right back in just a second.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one. You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome LaVeisha Davis to the show. She is a virtual family office expert. It is a new concept that is revolutionizing how high net worth families, business owners, grow and protect their wealth. She has been helping families for quite a while and has been very successful with it. She has some cool methodologies like the family CEO mindset and breaking the cycle and some ideas like this that we're going to talk about. LaVeisha, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I am well, Jim. Thank you for having me. It's certainly a pleasure to be here and talk about such a dynamic topic.
So tell us about it. How'd you get started with this?
You know, I have been in financial planning for well over 10 years and through a number of experiences myself, being an entrepreneur and understanding the complex planning that can come with that, I decided to just service it full time. Again, from experience, we realized, hey, we need to know some basics about money in order for our entrepreneurship to be successful. So I decided to headship us taking on that knowledge, my husband and I, when I say us. And from there, I was like, I know we're not the only business owners that's struggling with things like separating our business operations to our own personal financial planning needs. And now I need to bring this to the attention of other business owners. And it had just grew from there.
Awesome. Who is your typical client these days?
So these days we service a lot of first generation founders who are the first in their family to create a business, have a successful business, and now their primary wealth is concentrated in their business. Those are the people that we help the most, where this is just a new world and they're trying to navigate it with their best foot forward, and we help them do that.
So what would their net worth be at this point? 5 million, 10 million?
So here, that's a good question. So when we look at things, we look at it from a balance sheet perspective. So most would assume that's just the net worth. But you know, your business doesn't fall there just yet. When you have a business that has substantial value, if it's not converted to cash, it's not there yet. So we look at your balance sheet as a whole. So those are that have somewhere between the 1 million and 30 million mark is who we serve the most, because they're the most underserved and more traditional financial institutions, especially under this wealth management concept of the family office. They're not even considered. So that's who we serve.
What is a family office? How does this?
Yeah,
I want my family to have an office.
Yes. And you know, Jim, you may already have one. We say this all the time. You have one. It may just be either dysfunctional or disorganized or just very fragmented. But a family office has been attached to luxury, I think, if for those that are familiar with it and those that aren't familiar with it, it's more of just a system. It's a structure that governs every aspect of capital that dictates your wealth and to prevent it from being lost. So when I say every type of capital, not just financial, that's one component, but there are other forms that have to be governed, structured, and managed, which is your intellectual capital, your social capital, and most importantly, is the human capital. So the family office manages all of those pieces to make sure that the wealth is preserved and to make sure that it transfers smoothly and to make sure it can fulfill the financial needs for the family that has been designed to serve.
What about tax law? How does tax law fit into all of this?
It's one of the leading reasons why you would start a family office. So most people or most times family offices are created from a major liquidity event, like you sold a business or some highly appreciated asset. Now you have all this money that needs management. Well, if you are fortunate enough to construct your family office before that major event happens, tax laws are considered on every level, one from income for each family member. And depending on, you know, what they do for themselves, if they're doing fairly well for themselves, may need tax planning on the individual level. But it's really about optimizing that time, that liquidity event. How can we ensure that we don't lose most of it to taxes? An example that we like to use is most business owners that are going to have a huge exit one day don't know that they can have up to $10 million of that exempt from capital gains tax if they structure and plan accordingly. So that's a major opportunity that can be reserved for your family's wealth that can turn into lifetime income.
That is what people want. That is so mm-hmm. cool. All right. I love it. Let's talk about some of these topics that you specialize in. For example, the family CEO mindset. What is that?
That's the mindset, the transformation to understand that there are two types of businesses you're going to be engaged in. You have the business that makes you money, your operating business, but then you have your wealth business, which is where the money grows, gets protected, and passes on. And in order for wealth to be lasting in a family past the first generation, it has to be led with intent with the CEO in the front, just like any other type of business or company that we deem successful. So the family CEO is now stepping up and recognizing that my family is a business and we are in the wealth business. And I am taking that leadership role to make sure our wealth stays in our family. So the family CEO, just like a CEO of a major corporation, is now going to assemble the team of professionals and outsource the services needed to make sure that that's the outcome that they get. Because it's not going to happen by accident. It only happens with intent.
Are you the CEO then? When they hire do you become the CEO?
That's a great question as well. We consider it a co-CEO. So one of the responsibilities of the family CEO is operating within their strengths. You may not know how to manage assets or minimize taxes or structure your wealth business. That may not be your area of expertise. So here at LWS Advisors, we kind of do a co-CEO role with you and build that virtual family office and outsource those things as necessary while we report to you on the findings, the reportings quarterly, but semi-annually or annually. So you always know the position of your wealth.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that young people should inherit a whole bunch of money? I happen to know some wealthy people, and I was at a 25th birthday party. And the guy turning 25 got $75 million check that day.
Mm.
And now he's a Pilates instructor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's it's twofold to that. No, they should not just inherit a lot of money. What they should inherit is a system. That's what we mean by separating the wealth business. Not to say they don't have access to it, but they understand the bigger mission and the bigger objectives of what we're supposed to do to be great stewards of our assets. So with that $75 million, you may have seen him get the check, but I, with that amount of wealth, I am confident that there is a system behind it that that check is going to get turned over to that he can operate within. That's just not in his personal bank account.
Yeah, it was.
So no, they shouldn't.
Yes, it was. Oh. He blew every cent of it.
Oh, and that's devastating news. And that's exactly what we don't want to happen, which is why we create the system instead. And the underlying assets or cash is just a component of it, but they can just change over to the seed. So we don't believe in just handing over cash. That's not very helpful. What we encourage, though, is even for young people to be able to participate, you know, developing them as the new wealth creators is going to add value. And you're going to need cash to do that, but you just don't get the check. You get a system. Customized approach, whether you have a structured loan, whether you and you still have to submit business plans, your ideas, it has to go through the loan committee, just like it was if you were out in the traditional world. It's just the system that they need to step into. That's what we encourage when we do succession planning.
You talk about breaking the cycle. What is that? What's the cycle that you're wanting to break?
The cycle of rags to riches, back to rags again. That's the cycle we want to break. Traditionally, wealth does not last past the second generation, over 70% and over 90% not into the third generation. And why that's devastating is now more than ever, we can see how important it is for self-sustainability, being able to provide for your own family. So the cycle we want to break is dependency and lost wealth. Over $200 billion over the last 20 years has been collected to the IRS just from the lack of estate planning. They literally have gotten that handed over because if we don't choose who we want our assets left to, the government wins that lottery every time. So there's a number of cycles, but that rags to riches, back to rags again is number one.
All right. Let's switch the topic of conversation just a little bit. Talk to us about building your business. I mean, this is a business that you've built. Talk to us about being an entrepreneur in this space. What difficulties have you encountered? Be an entrepreneur and tell us a little history.
Yeah. So my entrepreneur journey, aside just from the wealth management firm that we've built today that services over eight family offices across six states. I'm sorry, over 21 family offices across six states. It has been bumpy like most entrepreneur journeys. So what I encourage entrepreneurs is to think about the end in mind and reverse engineer your plan. Sometimes we get so caught up in the beginning stages that we forget what we're striving for. So what do you want this business to do for you and your family? Do you want it to be a big payday? Do you want it to be a lifetime income? Do you want to transfer it to one of your children in the future? Think about what you want to do, like what you're really becoming an entrepreneur for, and not be driven by the short-term things that you think is going to do it, like working for yourself or creating your own hours. It's bigger than that. And I have been fortunate, my husband and I have been very fortunate to always have that perspective. So we've been able to build and sell companies in our entrepreneur journey. But sometimes entrepreneurs get lost in the sauce because we're in the day-to-day wearing all the different hats, right? But remember to wear the hat or keep your family in mind first. And remember that this is either for them in some capacity, and then now we got to build the plan that includes them along the way. It can be very isolating on this entrepreneur journey if you're not careful. You get very wrapped up in chasing the bottom line, growing the company, growing the value. You get very caught up in that, and it's easy to prioritize that over the things that's most important, like your family and spending time with your loved ones. So two things can be true. You can be chasing your dream, but you also have to prioritize the ones you love. And what better way to do that than to remember what you're doing it for and put that on the board every day and work backwards to fulfill it and get that outcome.
How do you do marketing these days? How do you get new clients?
So for me, it's our referral base at our firm, because this is a very, I won't say just exclusive service, like it's not accessible, but in order for you to get the attention that you need, there does have to be a cap on the people that we serve. So we operate off of a referral basis. And while we are serving the clients that we have right now, they usually have come with those referrals. But we do try to build a community that people still have access to the education and the resources that we do provide some of our clients to. So that comes with our website, mywealthandlegacy.com. And it also has a free ebook there for you to download about taking on that mentality of family CEO and how to make that mental transformation.
Excellent. And when you are talking about that transformation, does it need to be the entrepreneur? Could it be someone else in the family? Does it have to be the guy who made the money?
Absolutely. For my own personal journey, when I became a family CEO, it was in response to tragedy. Unfortunately, my brother was a victim of violence and we lost him very early. And it was devastating watching my mother lose her only son. And at that time, we were very early in our entrepreneur career. So we didn't collectively have the resources to bury him and to give him a proper home going and to make sure that his daughter, our niece, that was 10 years old at the time, to make sure she didn't go without. And it was that was the eye opener for me that families have to work together, especially in those times. So what I stepped up and became the famous CEO in that moment, even though I was the entrepreneur. But there are many people who can relate that there's different triggering events that will make you decide to step up and say, no, I'm going to lead my family to prosperity, whether that's my strength or not. And I'm going to fill those areas that are not my strengths. It does not just have to be the entrepreneur. We just need a leader.
All right. And what are the skills that that leader needs to have? What do you look for when you pick someone out of the family to be that leader?
Well, you definitely need to be forward thinking. You need to be able to consider the future. You have to be able to be very considerate of other people. You have to realize that your efforts, you may not be able to see the fruit of your efforts in your particular generation or lifetime. You may, because things have sped up quite a bit in the environment we live in today. But the forward thinking you have to have, you be very organized. You have to be very authoritative, but not in a way that is like condescending, in a way that will get your family's buy-in, because you're going to be asking them to participate in something that they can't see just yet either. And it's going to take time before the vision that you are painting for them actually comes to life and fruition and tangible. So you have to be a leader. You have to be able to get the buy-in, and you have to be a strong forward thinker to be able to be that family CEO.
And what kind of diversification do you do? You know, so they get this big exit, they just sold their business, they have $50 million. What are your suggestions on how to diversify it and invest that for the future in the long term?
Well, see, that's a great question too. And although it's on a case-by-case basis of how we would actually be allocating those type of funds, but there is a model. There is a family office model to be followed when trying to allocate and have true diversification and not be too concentrated in one area. So one example I can give you is it'll be about, let's see. Okay, let's do it like this. So it'll probably be about 32% in equities. It may be about 12% in bonds. It might be about 21% in private equity. It might be about 10% in cash, another 12% in private debt, maybe 4% in hedge funds, maybe 1% in commodities. But somewhere around that should equal about 100%. But that's true diversification. And when we're trying for things that are uncorrelated, because once you get that $50 million, it's about preservation at that point. It's about not losing. I mean, growth is what we want to, but it's more focused on not losing. So you have to make sure you have a balanced portfolio in that particular situation to avoid losses.
I love that ratio that you had there of all the different asset classes. Very interesting. Why do some families do this so well? You know, you hear about the Rockefellers, that they're still wealthy. And then you hear about the Vanderbilts and they're all broke. What happened there?
system versus no system. The Rockefellers has a very sophisticated system and a very sophisticated mission. So everyone is working on one accord under the same mission and objective within the system and parameters that has been put in place. When we say that, we mean like sometimes everything that glitters looks gold. So what we put in place is something called an investment policy statement or an investment mandate that clearly outlines what we are permitted to invest in a given time, in a given period of time. And then once we have reached that, if family needs capital, there's a defined system. Like I said, that loan committee is a huge component of the Rockefeller system. You still have to apply for a loan. We're just giving you some leniency on the interest rate. You may not have to pay market interest, but you still have to do this in a loan format because we need this capital to be able to generate income for us for an extended period of time. So the Rockefellers were focused on continuity. That's what their system was focused on, while the Vanderbilts didn't have a system that focused on continuity, and it was focused on spending and just giving that big check like you just described. So that's the big difference. Family offices focus on continuity. Traditional planning usually focuses on retirement.
I know another family they had a family office. They had everything. And daddy lived longer than people thought daddy should live. And so the kids started suing daddy because he was alive too long and they wanted their inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just a disaster. Then one of the kids found out that he was visiting prostitutes like 50 at a time and stuff. And it was just quite the little circus here in Atlanta for us all to watch. And that family office just disintegrated. And it's sad to see that. Really just sad to see them. All of them suing each other. Just so nasty. Just nasty.
It is very nasty. And family conflict is almost, you know, a natural occurrence. And that's the reason why succession planning is so important. I don't know what amount of wealth was at stake or what amount of inheritance they were seeking.
Billion. It was about a $10 billion family.
Yeah. Without speaking directly about that family, like there's a difference between, you know, structure and planning and just flat out like greed or other emotional responses to the wealth. What was it that you were chasing? Did you want the entire amount of wealth? Did you just not have a set of resources that were allocated to you for you to pursue what you consider to make you happy or what you're going to do to contribute to our wealth? Like there is just so many questions I could ask in that particular situation. But when you are, it's still human behavior that has to be managed in this thing also.
Yes, it is. How do we find out more? Follow you online. Get in touch. Get a copy of that ebook you mentioned.
Yes, thank you so much. So I try to simplify things in this world of complex social interaction. So everything is under my name, Lavasia Davis, LAVASHA. That's LinkedIn. That's Facebook. That's Instagram. That's Threads. That's X. Everything is under there. And that ebook can be located at mywealthandlegacy.com, and you're welcome to download that ebook. And if you want to take things even a step further in wanting to evaluate if a family office wealth management solution is for you, I would encourage you to reach out to me directly and we can have a conversation about that.
Fantastic. That makes a lot of sense. And that's a very nice offer. Thank you so much. We are out of time, but you know what we do? That's right. We come back tomorrow. Be safe. Take care. Have a great day. Bye now. Go make $1 million.